This is not one of those. This is a prison. It's a jail. I'm not here to give him any advice. I can't do anything. I just came to give him my support. I also came to this place on a patera's boat with some friends. I've been here 8 years now. 2 years ago, I was brought to a detention center for minors, too. There, I got my papers, and I was free to make my life. I met a lot of people when I was coming to Europe who, after just 4 years, have gotten all they wanted, a house, a car, everything.
Despite extensive coverage by the media and the opinions of the majority of the people, only 4% of immigrants actually come to Spain by illegal boats. But how does this trip begin?
Llegué en España en 2010 cuando estaba en mi país.
I arrived in Spain in 2010 while I was living in Burkina Faso. One of my cousins was living here in Spain. One day while thinking, I said to myself, why don't you do what he did? Why don't you pack everything and go to Spain? My father gave me the money that was supposed to pay for my studies, and I used it to leave the country. One morning, I awoke very early. I turned my back and I left. I found a Tuareg who told me he could take me to Spain. We gave him about 70 euros or something like that. Then he said he needed to find more people interested, because the two of us were not enough. We hung around the whole day, drinking only water and eating bread. He came days later with more people. We traveled through the desert. It took us about 3 days to cross it. After around 30 kilometers or maybe more, he said, look, go that way and Spain is behind that mountain. We had been completely fooled. I only had a pair of sandals and my feet were bleeding. It was awful. I was crying. Fortunately, we found a Tuareg village where they treated us very well and gave us water and bread. And they asked us where we were going. We answered to Spain, and a woman said to us, you're crazy, Spain is that way. It's a long trip to get there. I went to the border of Morocco and Algeria. There were a lot, and I mean a lot of Africans, really, a lot of them. Some had been there for 8 or 10 years wanting to get to Spain. If they ask you to pay them 1,500 euros, you give the money to them. It was December 30, 2009, when a Moroccan guy came to me with a gun, a machete and a stick, like a golf stick. He said, get ready, we're going to Spain tonight. Fast, 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 he was hitting us and pointing at us with his gun. When I arrived at the sea, I had never seen the sea before, I'd never been close to it, so when I saw the waves, I was terrified. No, 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 I'm not going into the boat. No way, no. A friend said to me, dude, you have to. Don't you see the gun and the machete? If you don't do it, they'll kill you. Then I prayed and got into the boat. It took us about 24 hours. First, we were stopped by the Guardia Civil, and they asked us how many we were. We were 46. When we got there, we were not able to talk. People were throwing up and crying. 30 minutes later, the Red Cross arrived. And after that, they took us to the police station for questioning. At the time, I was 13 years old.
In my case, the journey to Spain was like a dream, because I'd always had this dream to go to Europe. I studied until the age of 25, and when I finished my studies, I moved to a city in Senegal called Ambour to work in the hotel industry. I was earning 150 euros a month, but I wanted to have a better future. The tourists used to tell us, and especially to me, for example, to come to Europe as if Santa Claus was living in Europe. One day, I heard from a friend that there were some Patera's boats leaving for Spain. The trip was about 800 euros. It was easier than getting a visa to come to Europe, which would have cost around 5,000 to 6,000 euros. When you're in need, you don't really understand the dangers ahead. You realize the risks when it's too late and you're in the middle of the sea. Then I gave him the money. He wrote down my phone number and told me he was going to call me in more or less 2 weeks. One afternoon, it was around 8 p.m. or 9 p.m., he told me that my trip was arranged for that same day at midnight. In the Patiras boat, we were 98 people. There was water and food, but no one ate anything. We were all too afraid. We left on Friday the 12th, and we arrived at Costa del Hierro on the 18th, a week later. On arrival, we were detained by the Spanish Civil Guard, who kept us till the afternoon and then sent us to the island of Tenerife. We stayed there for the weekend, in a police station. Then we were sent to a garage where they had around 800 people like me. In 2006, Patiras would arrive very frequently. We were kept at that location for another weekend.
...96% of the illegal immigrants navigate the French-Spanish border and to the airport of Barajas. Annually, among 40,000 or 50,000 become victims of sexual slavery. It's the second most profitable business after weapons trafficking. The third is drug dealing.
I arrived in Spain when I was 18. I came here, sold to the mafia who brought me here. Since I arrived in Spain, I've been working as a prostitute. They were clear and told me the kind of job I was going to do. Then I came. I stopped working for a long time because I fell in love with one of my clients. He took me out of that life and we were married for 4 years. The first few months were wonderful because I really was in love with him. But after 3 months, I fell pregnant, and 15 days after I gave birth, he started beating me. It was the first time he did that. I was beaten up so badly by him that I ended up in hospital. Apparently, he had been a drug addict practically his whole life, and I never knew it. Then his life became a complete mess, and he was sent to jail. I kept the baby. From the hospital, I was sent directly to a shelter house for abused women in welfare. 4 months later, he found me. I forgave him, and we got back together again. But then he started to beat me again and treat me terribly, and that became a normal thing. I kept drinking and started using drugs, alcohol. Then he took control of my child and forced me to bring money for the house. At the end, I was abused. He later threatened me, saying I can't see my child anymore, even though I was the one who took care of him all this time. He asked for a restraining order. I had to leave the house because of this order, and now I can't come close to my child anymore. I tried to kill myself taking pills, something quite normal. I was hospitalized in a psychiatric ward in Seville. I said to myself that I had to leave this place and I had to be cured at all costs. After a while, I was sent to Jerez de la Frontera, and there I received help from the Institute's project manager. After more or less 2 months, I received a letter saying that I had to go to prison in order to execute my deportation orders out of the country. I was very worried. I thought about my situation and asked the institution for permission to appear on television to tell my story, look for some help, find a way forward. I'm the mother of that child. How can they tear me away from my child if I'm trying to become cured? The National Police called the institution looking for me. They sent me a subpoena to appear at 9 a.m. When I arrived, they said to me, Mrs. Bibiabe, sit down. We are going to read you your rights. You are under arrest and will be sent to the detention center for migrants so that they can deport you back to your country.
What is a detention center for migrants?
The detention center for migrants are covered by the EU legislation because they are all over Europe and in the Spanish legislation. It's an exceptional measure because freedom is the standard.
It's the first place where people are detained, whether to ensure their presence during the management of an expulsion file or to execute a deportation order whenever it's possible. And I stress, only when it's possible.
In exceptional circumstances, a person can be arrested when certain terms provided by the law are set out. It is especially for when there's a risk of escape or risk of danger to public safety, and it's always at a non-prison facility to execute a deportation. The only right they don't have while they are detained in those places is the right to freedom. The rest of their civil rights remain. However, in practice, they are deprived of more than just freedom.
In Andalusia, we have 2.5 detention centers for migrants. Let me explain why they have. There's one in Malaga, and in the province of Cadiz we have another, which is a detention center in Algeciras, and we have a small branch in Tarifa.
Nowadays, only the one in Algeciras is still active, and the branch in Tarifa. In June 2012, after many negative reports, the center in Malaga was closed down. In the neighborhood of Palma, Palmilla, the poorest district in the city, a location in which more than 40% of residents are migrants, we found Rita, who came to Spain via the ferries that arrived at Algeciras. Rita has been deported 17 times and detained at others. He has 21 days of experience of the living conditions at the Cappuccino CIE.
Soy de Marruecos, tengo 24 años. Era los 16 así, ya decidí salir de ahí.
I'm from Morocco, and I'm 24 years old. When I was 16, more or less, I decided to leave my country. I wasn't really thinking to come to Spain. I was thinking of going further. The further, the better. Whenever I made the attempt, every time I would dress elegantly, merging with the other passengers, with the buses and the people. There are many fences and I would jump over them. Sometimes there's a lot of security, a lot, and many cameras. I would wait for security to look away or for them to be occupied with something else. The transport takes me to the ship or near the ship. Once I'm there, there are buses, trucks, cars that I can get in. There's not much security there. Before arriving at the area where the ferry is, yes, there is security. But once you are close to the ship, not too much security. Then what I do is find a car and hide under it. The wheels are small, but you have the part of the tubes that connect the wheels, and so I got in there. Once I'm on the ship, I find a quiet place to hold up. When the ship arrives in Algeciras, I sneak off.
Me cogieron, la policía me cogieron y me metieron en el centro de menores. He estado ahí un año y pico. Bueno, claro, a los tres meses.
So I got off at Algeciras and I was captured by the police and sent to a juvenile facility where I stayed for more than a year. Well, after 3 months, I got my papers and started looking for a job. I was working with a guy at a butcher's shop. He lent me 3,000 euros, and then what happened? Okay, I'm working with you and I'll pay you bit by bit. His answer is no, I have a better way. He wanted me to go to Morocco and bring in some drugs. He bought 2 kilos and told me to bring them here. But before I got here, I was caught. So I couldn't do it. When I was caught, they took me directly to the police station. Directly to the CIE. The one in Malaga.
Cuando me cogieron ya y me llevaron. Ya directamente a la comisaría y directamente al CIE. CIE de Málaga, el primero de Málaga.
In the neighborhood of Palmilla lives activist and human rights lawyer José Cosin, a person who knows well the detention center for migrants in Malaga, as he helped to close it completely.
I've been there many times, but in short periods of time. Whenever you were there, you felt a terrible sadness. It's a dirty place, leaking all the time. It used to be the building for the police's canine unit, but they vacated due to the lack of sanitary conditions to keep the dogs, but they were fine to keep migrants there.
El centro de entrenamiento no es una cárcel, pero o eso dicen, pero todo lo demás es como una cárcel.
Supposedly the detention center is not a prison, but that's what they say, although everything else is like a prison or worse. In prison, There are penitentiary rules that cover the rights of prisoners. However, these detention centers are overcrowded. These innocent migrants with no prior criminal records are put together with other prisoners that may be dangerous and, due to their fears of deportation, might become very violent. There was a lot of people suffering, many innocent people and ordinary people like you or me, architects, professionals. They were at risk as they were not receiving the proper attention. The police officers feel overwhelmed because they are not doctors. There is no thought to ever call on emergency medical services, and there has been many, well, several cases of death in custody in Spain that, in my opinion, the Spanish Prison Administration are responsible for because they hadn't monitored the physical health of the people in their custody.
And how is life inside these centers?
You wake up at 8 o'clock in the morning, then you come down at 8 or between 8 and 8:30 at the latest. You come down and you have a coffee and a couple of cupcakes. Then we stay in the yard or we sit at a place with tables. You can play a game or watch TV and so on. It's a rundown old building and it could fall down at any time. There were fences inside. At times, one of the inmates might make a joke with someone else or whatever. And the officer starts thinking, of course, because he might not understand what they are saying. And he concludes that they are fighting. So he calls them over to the window. And when they go, they try to explain and maybe he still doesn't understand or he doesn't want to. You know what I mean? So sometimes they put them in there and beat them. They try not to leave any mark in case the inmate decides to report it or something.
The story here at Chinos is one of scandal, sadness, and suffering. The first case of details becoming public, they made the international media, and they were reports of sexual abuse of the women at the detention centers for migrants at the hands of those that were supposed to protect them, the national police. Witnesses and the victims were all deported immediately so as to stop them from testifying. Spanish legislation, however, stipulates that whenever there is a pending trial, those involved cannot be deported. The police officers accused of sexual abuse have seen their jobs and salaries suspended, although I have information that they still work for the police institutions. In the end, we achieved closing the place down, although I always say it's a bittersweet victory because all they do is traffic them into other detention centers. The case was closed in this instance because for them it was a cheaper way out than solving it. That's why I say it's bittersweet, because there are many CIEs that still need to be closed, plenty of them.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile...
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi...
Shahid Muhammad Baqir Al-Sadr. He was born in Qadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We're welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, an introduction into the lives and works of the Muslim dignitaries and Shiite scholars and ulama all across the world of Islam. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyani. Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyani, assalamu alaikum to you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Today we want to talk about Abu Ali Hussein ibn Abdullah ibn Sina, mainly known as Ibn Sina. In English translation and transliteration, it is translated into Avicenna, what is known in the, we can say, Latin and the English world. The outstanding philosopher and thinker of Iran, or better say, Persia. So let's be more familiar with the early life of Ibn Sina. Sheikh Mahdavi, let's start with you, brother.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ibn Sina, commonly known in the West, as you mentioned, Ibn Sina was a Persian polymath.
Yes.
So we can say most of the titles that we might have for the scholars, like being a great physician, a great astronomer, a great, as one of the most and distinguished title, philosopher. As you mentioned, he is a Persian, but being born in Bukhara in 980, according to Gregorian calendar, in a Persian family. Then he moved from Bukhara, he moved to a city called Gurganj, which belongs to the Uzbekistan nowadays.
Yes.
But from there he moved to Gurgan, which is the Iranian, maybe it's kind of sister city to Gurganj that we have the other side.
Okay.
So he moved to Gurgan in Iran, and then from Gurgan to Ray, and finally he stayed in Hamadan and passed away over there, whereby his tomb is located. Avicenna, or Ibn Sina, is mainly known for reviving the Aristotelian philosophy in the world of Islam. Because before him, we had some of the scholars who had this inclination and tendency toward the Aristotelian philosophy. I mean, the philosophy which was founded by Aristotle. But we see at the time of Avicenna or Ibn Sina, this kind of approach upon the philosophy was more modified Islamically, because it does not belong, it has no root in Islam, but it was in need of kind of modification according to the Islamic rulings, specifically in terms of theology.
That's right.
Yes.
Okay.
And this type of approach later on called Falsafe Masha.
Yes.
Which is mainly the title which is mainly given to this school of thought.
That's right.
Because of its founder as Aristotle. It is common that the moment Aristotle was teaching, he was walking.
Yes.
And the term Masha is coming from the Mashi in Arabic, meaning walking. Even some of the historians has said that Ibn Sina was following the same approach in the time that he was teaching, so his disciples and students gather around him, and he was walking and teaching at the same time. So the title of Masha that Ibn Sina and his type of philosophy is famous in the world of Islam has nothing to do with those philosophical intention and objectives. But the more important thing in terms of philosophy and his efforts and attempts in philosophy is this, that he is regarded as those who revived and modified Aristotelian philosophy. And this is only part of his life.
That's right.
Okay. As you mentioned, and I said at the beginning of my talk, he is also known as a great physician.
Yes.
That his book as the canon, if I'm not mistaken.
Al-Qanun,
yes. The canon of medicine
Yes.
is one of the most famous book in terms of medicine that's still being taught and studied in West.
Okay. Most of his books have been compiled in the Arabic language, but let's get back to Masha philosophy. Give us more details about this Masha philosophy. What are the features of this type of look at the world?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As my brother Sheikh Mahdavi mentioned, the root of Masha philosophy is rooted in the Aristotelian philosophy and is not, you know, initiated by Muslim philosophers.
Yes.
But this school of thought was promoted by Muslim philosophers like Al-Farabi and also Ibn Sina and the rest of these scholars that are known in this field. But to clarify the characteristics of this school of thought, we should get to know the meaning of the terms that are standing beside this Masha school of thought.
Yes.
So we should know that there are three main types of philosophy known in Islamic philosophy. Number one is Masha philosophy. Yes. Number two is Israq. And number three is Hikmatul Muta'aliyah.
Yes.
In Masha philosophy, that is the school of thought that Ibn Sina is the head of this school of thought, the main emphasis is put on intellect and intellectual argumentation.
Yes.
So if they want to talk about the existence and essence, they go through logic and intellectual argumentations rather than intuition and these, you know, ways of getting familiar with metaphysics.
Okay.
No, they just try to get benefit from the reasoning
and rational reasoning and argumentation.
Yeah, and rational argumentation.
Okay. So you mean kashf and shuhud, these things which are more seen, for example, in Ishraq and Muta'aliyah philosophy, are not seen at all in Masha, isn't it?
Yes, mainly they are not.
Okay.
Of course, because Ibn Sina is a Muslim philosopher, so wherever he cannot justify the philosophical issues, like, for example, human being in the hereafter, he says, okay, although I cannot justify this stuff with my rational power, so, but again, because it is revealed in the Holy Quran and it is mentioned over there, so I accept it according to my beliefs, but I cannot give a justification through my mind for this.
Okay.
So we should say that, yes, Masha philosophy is based on rational argumentation and intellectual reasoning,
okay,
but to the point that it does not contradict with the teachings, or let me say with the basic elements or basic teachings of Islam. Wherever it comes to contradict the basic rules of Islamic understanding of the world, then Masha philosophy would say that, okay, maybe I'm not able to, you know, understand the world correctly.
Okay.
So I should correct my reasoning. The same that Ibn Sina talks about the hereafter when he comes to this issue.
That's right.
So we should say that, in a sentence, Masha philosophy is relying on intellect to the point that it would not be in contradiction with the Islamic understanding of the universe.
Okay, that's all right. So everything is under the umbrella and shadow of Islam and Islamic teachings, even this rationality,
yes.
Okay?
Yes.
It is not like, for example, some, secular philosophy, which consider rational and human intellect at the topmost power in order to understand the world, isn't
exactly. it? Exactly. And that's why we call it Islamic philosophy.
Islamic philosophy.
We don't call it pure philosophy.
Pure philosophy. That's all right.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha
illallah. Okay, Sheikh Mahtavi, as you said, he had so many works. I mean, Al-Qanun, you referred to that. What about the other works of Ibn Sina?
Okay, for Ibn Sina, there are a lot of works that could be referred to if we wanted to. Actually, we have to ask for the specific fields of study, then we can present yes. from his side.
Okay.
As it is known that he had kind of above 400 works from which something around 250 has or have survived.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of books, including books and treaties.
Yes.
So regarding the physician and medicine, as I mentioned, the canon of medicine, but regarding the philosophy, we have the book Ash-Shifa, or the healing, if yes. we wanted to translate it as it is translated. So, we have the book Al-Isharat wa Tanbihat that yes. later on was commented by Khwaja Nasiruddin Tusi, and it is regarded as one of the main book in which you can find the whole ideology or the whole principles of falsafah Masha.
Okay.
Because the
so
book,
this is the main textbook on Masha philosophy.
Yes, it was the book that was commented on the. Actually, mm-hmm. the main book was written by Ibn Sina, but yes. after something around 3 centuries, we see that Khwaja Nasiruddin Tusi commented on his book so that he clarified and explained about all of the ideas, and Khwaja Nasir played a key role in terms of reviving the philosophy that Ibn Sina had kind of initiated in the world of Islam, because the philosophy that Ibn Sina presented in the world of Islam, we see that was criticized mm-hmm. within 20, 30 years.
Yes.
We have Ghazali after yes, him, yes. criticizing him, so writing yes, rewriting a book, giving the title of Tahafutul Philosopher, meaning the conflicts of the philosopher, and he was pointing out to the contradiction or those conflicts that are existing among the philosopher themselves, intending or implying to say that if there is a truth, they shouldn't disagree each other.
Mm-hmm.
So if all of them are philosophers, all of them are presenting something yes. about the truth, why are they conflicting each other? So this confliction or this conflict and contradiction indicates that nothing is there behind their talks and their books.
Yes.
So after Ghazali and Fakhr Razi, we have a very strong and heavy critic against this type of philosophy that Ibn Sina presented in the world of Islam. But again, we see how it was revived through the works of Khwaja Nasiruddin Tusi. Regarding the main ideas, if I don't yes. know, we have time to talk about the main ideas presented in Falsafeya Masha. We can say the main idea is principality of essence.
Yes.
That 10 intellects, I don't know if I am correct, we have Ughula Ashare.
Yes, yes.
This is the way through which they would explain about, or they would explain the whole universe.
Yes.
Through Ughula Ashare.
Okay, just to want to make the distinction between Hikmat al-Masha and Hikmat al-Ishraq and Hikmat al-Muta'aliyah more clear, we should say that Hikmat al-Masha is emphasizing on intellectual argumentation, but Hikmat al-Ishraq is emphasizing on intuition and internal connection with metaphysics.
Yes.
So there is a very famous saying that it is said the head of Hikmat al-Ishraq had a meeting with one of the heads of Hikmat al-Masha.
Mm-hmm.
And after this meeting, that it was lasted for some days, when they came to these two scholars and asked them, how did you find each other? The one that was from Hikmat al-Masha, he said that whatever I was thinking about, the philosopher of Hikmat al-Ishraq, he was seeing what I was thinking about. And when they asked the philosopher of Hikmat al-Ishraq, how did you find the other professor, I mean the head of Hikmat al-Masha, he said that whatever I'm witnessing,
yes.
this scholar is just talking about it.
Uh-huh.
So this is the difference. And when it comes to Hikmat al-Muta'aliyah, we should say that Hikmat al-Muta'aliyah tries to combine these two.
Yes.
Plus, there are some basic differences.
Yes.
That I'm sure that I'm suspicious that maybe this get a little bit
technical.
You know, technical discussion. Yes. But I think that it's good to know that this one at least.
Yes.
That's in Hikmat al-Masha, they do not believe in Harikat Johariya. That means that the essence of a thing cannot have movement inside itself.
Yes.
So it should be stable.
Yes.
But Mullah Sadra in Hikmat al-Muta'aliyah, he proves that the essence of everything has an internal movement is inside itself, so that it gets promoted moment by moment from the beginning of its life to the end. Of course, this discussion, one of the most crucial issues that has been, you know, at the core of the discussions among philosophers, even nowadays.
One thing left, I actually forgot to talk about one of his main work in Farsi that is going to help us, or actually those who are interested in the ancient Farsi or Persian language, which belongs to the 5th century. We see that he has put all of these thought, I mean the philosophical and logical thought, in a book entitled Danishname-e Alai. So he wrote the whole book in Farsi, because actually this is under the request of the ruler of Isfahan, whose name was Alauddin Kakuyeh.
Yes,
that's why, because this governor tells him with that Farsi, it's really nice if we quote the Farsi sentence for that century, saying that agar ulum avayel be ibarat parsi budi man tavanestami danestan, saying that if you had written your knowledge in Persian language, and there is a story why all of the scholars would write their things in Arabic language, because at back then Arabic was the academic language for the whole world. Even Persian scholars, they were forced to present their knowledge in Arabic language. So we see how this governor of the city Isfahan requests Ibn Sina to write your knowledge in Farsi so that I can understand. Yes. That has a very nice history behind it. Unfortunately, today's in our world, we are forced to present our knowledge in English. Why? Because English has been chosen as the international language. But back in the history, we see before the Renaissance, we had Arabic language being as the academic language.
That's all right. And so many outstanding scholars in the Western world were influenced by the thought of Ibn Sina, especially his books on, as you said, medicine, you know, for so many years. And still, they are translated and taught in the European universities and academies all across the world. Thank you much, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziyaniya. He passed away at the age of 58, and his body was taken into the city of Hamadan in today's Iran, and he's buried over there. May Allah bless the soul of Ibn Sina, who passed away in the year 428, according to the lunar Hijri calendar. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher, which was about Ibn Sina or Avicenna. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanillah.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
In the words of the Ahlul Bayt, in the teachings of the Quran, one of the life practices, one of the secrets to success is bridging this gap between what we need to know and what we do know, and what we do know and what we act upon. We talked about how, you know, the examples of the Jahili poetry, and we said that, you know, this sounds really familiar, this idea of this means of sound and words being used to have appeal to the lowest and the base instincts of human beings. It was there back then, and it's there right now. Similarly, this concept of living in a state of doubt, it's something which is described to us in the Quran. Allah Ta'ala in Surah Dukhan, He says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم, رَبِّ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ وَمَا بَيْنَهُمَا إِن كُنْتُم مُوقِنِينَ. The reality is that there is one Rabb. There is one entity. There's one being who is in charge. He's the one who is governing. He's the one who is making the laws. He's the one who is the source of all blessings. He's the one who is nurturing you. He's the one who's taking care of you and of everyone in the skies and the earth. But if only you can have certainty in that. Unfortunately, there are those who lack the ability to find certainty in this. They can't arrive at this certainty. They're always in a state of uncertainty. And how are they described? La ilaha illa huwa yuhyi wa yumit. He is the only one who's worthy of being worshipped. He gives life. He gives death. Rabbukum wa rabbu abaikum al-awwalin. He's your Rabb. He's your nurturer. He's your cherisher. He's your Lord. And of those who came before you. But there are people, بَلْهُمْ فِي شَكٍ يَلْعَبُونَ. There are people who are in a permanent state of shak. They satisfy themselves, how? By being in a state of doubting. Oh, I'm not sure about that. I'm going to question that. What do they say? They say that, isn't it arrogant of you to assume that there is something which is true for everyone? That's right for everyone? How can you make such a claim? Everyone is their own individual. Everyone has a voice for themselves. And the Quran calls them out. بَلْهُمْ فِي شَكٍ يَلْعَبُونَ. They're playing around. لَعِب is somebody who's playing a game. That's okay for a child. It's okay for entertainment. But it's not supposed to be a permanent state where we escape from facing reality by putting ourselves into a situation where we can just be playing around. This is something which the Quran described, and it's something which we can see reflecting in our own world, in our own society. Sometimes it's not too hard to find the expression of this in things around us. I'll give you an example. Maybe some people will laugh at this. There's a well-known well-known song that goes with one of the Disney movies, which I'm sure all of you are familiar with, where one of the lines which is, you know, often repeated in that language, many kids have memorized and they say maybe better than the kalima, right? Which is what? It says, let it be, no right, no wrong, no rules for me, I just want to be free. Now, if you ponder upon this, no right, no wrong, no rules for me, I want to be free. Maybe it makes us a bit uncomfortable when we start to think about this, that, okay, this is a song, but words are made because of how? Like, why is it that certain words are chosen? Why is it that certain themes are being expressed? Why? Because they are an expression of dominant thought and culture. If it was something that was at odds with the dominant thought and culture, it wouldn't be used in a song that's meant to be popular. And so here you go. There is no right. There is no wrong. There are no rules. I'm a free person. I get to define. I get to construct what's right and what's wrong. I get to construct what's true and what's falsehood. That's a simple example, but let's take it and maybe talk about something a little bit more serious. If you go and look at the issue of Planned Parenthood, for example, right? And you look at, let's say, the Supreme Court's ruling on this topic, right? What is it that they say? It's very interesting. If you go and look at the words of the Supreme Justice, how he expresses his opinion on this topic. And again, when we talk about these things, I hope that inshallah we can, you know, be thinking and pondering and trying to learn from this. This is reflective of the society that we live in. What does he say? He says, at the heart of liberty, meaning that what does it mean to be truly free in the words of this lawmaking entity? At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. You see how this concept, it's an idea, but how it can turn into a law, which is now going to be something which is a very serious issue. That how much right do I have over my own body? How much right do I have over the life of others and what happens to them? This can be defined by what type of philosophical perspective I take on the concept of truth and falsehood. I'll give you another example, which is something that we all need to be very aware about. It's something which is affecting us in many different ways, which is the topic of identity. Because when you start to question, you know, what are the boundaries of right and wrong, and think of it arrogant to say that there is such a thing from before, then if you take that back and you roll it back to the core of it, then it starts to affect the concept of identity. You see it here in the words of the Supreme Justice, that at the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence. So does that mean that I get to define my own identity as well? Brothers and sisters, when we look at some of the challenges that our youth are facing, some of the social challenges, some of the areas where perhaps we're losing some of the young members of our community, it goes back to this core concept of identity. And in some cases, the issue goes back to when they were young, when what should have happened is that they should have gotten a correct perspective of who they are, of what their identity is. Who am I? Well, my faith identity, my gender identity, what is expected of me? What are the social norms? What is right and what is wrong? These are the things that are supposed to be ingrained when I'm a child, when I'm young. The Ahlul Bayt, they tell us that your time to teach your child is when they are young. Their heart, Imam Ali says, their heart is like that ground which is ripe to be cultivated. Plant the seeds at that time and then you'll see that they grow firm. But when somebody doesn't have that identity affirmation at the right age, then what happens is that when they face challenges in their life, then things can become very difficult for them.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Yani
Bazaar.
Almost everything around us is either made of plastic or has some plastic component. The use of plastic products in our daily lives is so widespread that many of our regular activities require a wide range of plastic accessories and products. Plastic is everywhere, from our homes to offices, businesses, and health centers. It is also used to make aeroplane parts, cars, trains, and so much more. Plastic is one of the most widely used materials due to its versatile features, which have boosted economies across the globe.
Well, hello there, and welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the program that analyzes profits, markets, industries, and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and internationally. This week, we are going to take a look at Iran's plastic production. We wanted to see how this market is doing and check out some major players in this sector. We will also peek into some of its contributions to the national economy. Enough said. Let's walk through today's Bazaar.
To become more familiar with plastic products and their production, we visited Parham Plast Aria. This company has been around for many years and is a major contender in the plastic products market. It makes hundreds of plastic-based products for a variety of uses. Some products are household plastic items such as baskets, dishes, utensils, and even larger things like chairs and tables. All things considered, this company provides some of the highest quality products found in the market. This is mainly because of its choice of raw material, which is rigorously tested for quality in its control labs. Moreover, raw materials such as polymers and additives are abundant inside the country. So, it doesn't have to look far for its feedstock. One of the advantages this company has is it controls the whole production and distribution process from design to sales.
In terms of household plastic products, there's always a thirst for newer and more stylish products coming from consumers. So companies must stay on their toes and create new molds each year to offer products that excite customers. However, making new molds is not always easy, and it can be an expensive process. That's why some companies choose to import molds instead, while others develop their own in R&D departments.
This company's research and development division is at the center of all productions. It is where new products are created. It is also tasked with keeping the company up to date in several fields, including production, consumer trends, and other domestic demands. Plus, it is no surprise that this unit is also where national and international standards for safety and durability are applied. It might be interesting to know that this company was a pioneer in setting standards through some of its products nationwide. Each year, this company evaluates the market to release the most recent product designs, giving it a competitive edge over other brands. Its massive production facilities can produce thousands of tons of products each year. As part of its future vision, this company is already expanding its facilities by launching a new production line. Once this new unit is up and running, it will add some 8,000 tons to its annual production. It also hopes to create its very own high-quality molds in the near future. This firm has overcome significant challenges over the years to enjoy its many achievements. Presently, this company is operating under its potential production capacity, and its ultimate goal is to use its full potential along the lines of exports.
Now, plastic is known as a group of synthetic or semi-synthetic materials created through the polymerization process. So, one of the most prominent ingredients in this mix is polymers, which are a derivative of petrochemical products that come from processing oil. It's not surprising that Iran has an ever-expanding polymer industry, given its large oil reserves.
We looked at some figures from the National Plastic and Polymer Industries Association. Data showed that the polymer industry gets most of its feedstock from domestic petrochemical complexes. Plus, there are some 8,000 production units that make plastic products nationwide. These units have a total capacity to produce roughly 13 million tons annually. Some $3.3 billion worth of polymer products were exported last year. That's according to the National Plastic and Polymer Industries Association. Furthermore, it says these exports registered a 23% increase compared to the year before. The association also says exports in this sector make up roughly 7% of the country's non-oil exports. Iran's oil and petrochemical industries are subject to US-imposed sanctions. Still, the wide variety of their products and high international demand has kept the market floating. On a broader scale, switching attention to added value products to boost non-oil exports has been a transformative move for Iranian industries. Through this, the country has tapped into its advanced domestic capabilities and diversified its economy toward a knowledge-based one. Household appliances are universal and an integral part of our modern daily life. Nearly all households have some sort of appliance meant to bring ease and comfort to everyday domestic tasks. Additionally, these items assist us in preserving and preparing food, cleaning our clothes, and overall helping us stay healthy. In general, the near 100% penetration of appliances in homes shows how crucial they are for our way of life and just how abundantly available these items are.
This week, we will journey through Iran's massive home appliance industry. We wanted to see how this sector has developed over the years and check out some major players in this manufacturing arena.
To become more familiar with this sector, we decided to visit Steel Alborz Industries. It was established 30 years ago and has since become a well-known household brand. This company began its work by producing steel sinks. Later, it added to its product basket and began